This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We all handle stress in different ways, but a recent Swedish study points to some serious concerns for women and the impact of stress on their lives. The study says that women who report stress in midlife from experiences like illness or divorce were more likely to have dementia or Alzheimer's in old age. But why? How are stress and diminished cognitive capacity later in life connected? Why does this seem to have more of an impact on women? All good questions that we hope to answer this hour. Dr. Greg Clary is Medical Director of In- and Outpatient Psychiatry in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health at Novant Health Presbyterian Medical Center. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
Lyndall Hare is a gerontologist and a midlife transitions and aging specialist for The Respite. That's a center for grief and hope for those who have suffered great tragedy, significant life loss, a trauma, a life-shaking, earth-shattering event or series of events. That's from your website. You're chuckling. I don't know what's funny about that. It's a lot of stuff, isn't it?
Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. And Sandy Lloyd Pearson is a licensed a clinical social worker, but she's actually here to share her story of coming to terms with loss, I believe, as an empty nester. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Good to see you. Let's begin with that Swedish study that we just referenced. Is this new information, or have we suspected for a while that there is a connection between trauma or tragedy or earth-shaking events in midlife for women that leads to dementia and Alzheimer's later in life? Doctor.
There's been speculation for this for years. There were studies in the late 90s, early 2000s that showed that late-life depression and depression led to microvascular changes within the brain that led people later in life to have dementing processes. I think at that time, there was no real differentiation between men and women, but it did show that depression led to worse outcomes in terms of cognitive functions. As well, there have been several really land-breaking studies with regard to coronary artery disease, congestive heart failure, and depression that have been very suggestive of problems with inflammation, coronary disease, dementing processes, basically shrinkage of the brain that have linked to depression and worse outcomes.
Do you know, or does medicine know, if there is a link between dementia or Alzheimer's and the kinds of events that happen in midlife in terms of the severity of the crisis in midlife versus the length of the crisis? Because some people can take years to get out of their midlife crises phase. Is it the length of time or the impact of that event?
I don't think anyone has really been able to quantify that. And I think part of the problem is that what is the definition of stress?
Yes.
Everyone's definition is different, sort of like the appraisal of pain. Some people are able to take certain things. Right now, you're very relaxed. You've done this a lot, whereas I'm an emotional wreck. So...
You have no idea what I'm going through right now, doctor.
Again, the differentiation of stress, I'm sure if somebody my wife one time, we were visiting Boston, and I had to go to Mass General Hospital, and she said that when I walked in the building, I walked differently than I did walking in, and she saw the difference between doctor and person at that time. It was the first time she'd ever seen that in me because she didn't go to work. But I think everybody adjusts to stress differently.
Yeah. This study, the Swedish study that looked, it looked at 800 women from 38 to 54 years of age, began in 1968, and they tracked them for over 37 years. They looked at people who reported stress in midlife from experiences like divorce or a family member's illness. It also reported that distress played a role. Is there a difference between stress and distress? I never thought about it before.
I think there is because, it's the coping skills in which you have at that particular point in time to handle what the stress is. I think biologically and hormonally, which has a great deal to do with what we're talking about today, women are far more equipped to deal with stress. There were many studies in the 60s and 70s that actually showed that women should be astronauts versus men because their decision-making capacity in stressful situations was far superior to what men would make. Men always went to the most aggressive solution versus mm-hmm. thinking out and making a better solution. But how does that accumulate in time? And I don't think anybody truly understands. We know the mechanistic evolution of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, but yet our treatment modalities are essentially zero.
You work, Lindell, with a lot of people who are going through stress, but also distress because of things that have happened to them in their lives. And I don't know precisely what we're talking about here, because I mentioned in your introduction that the Respite is a center for grief and hope for those who have suffered great tragedy, significant life loss, the trauma, life-shaking, earth-shattering events, or series of events. Is that stress, or is that distress, or is it both?
I would say that for the people I see in my practice, in my gerontology practice, I'm an elder care coach, mm-hmm. Mike, and so who I deal with mostly are people who are having to take care of somebody who has dementia, other types of age-related issues.
So you're dealing with caregivers.
I'm dealing mostly with caregivers, but I'm also dealing with people who come to me who are going into menopause. Who are finding that they're in immediate distress around their entire life sort of shape-shifting in front of them, and then all of these changes that occur that impact their lives. And the hormonal changes, as Greg was mentioning, I think are quite significant for those of us who've gone through menopause.
Their lives are shape-shifting because of menopause or because of the events in their lives, such as their parents getting older and needing more care?
I would say a confluence of both. Stress in caregiving is documented really well by the Alzheimer's Association. I can't tell you how amazing it is to see what people have to endure mm-hmm. when there are no resources, right. When the family doesn't have any resources, and all of that a lot of times falls on the women in the family.
I was going to say, you're talking about menopause and you're talking about caregiving, and menopause affects women, and caregivers predominantly mm-hmm. have been women. Do you deal with men at all?
I do, actually. I had a spate of men who came to me over a period of time, and I actually wrote a blog about male caregivers. Mm-hmm. Certainly, we're finding more and more in the field of aging, which I've been in here for 26 years now. I've seen a trend where men are stepping up to the plate because of circumstances and also because they're the closest person to the person who's needing care. Mm-hmm. And I think the field of aging has really embraced them more. In fact, I just read today that the Ivy Adult Daycare is holding its first male caregiver support group. So we're seeing more and more men, whereas maybe 10 years ago, most of the caregivers were definitely women.
So a lot of the problems, I think, from what I understood you to say, Dr. Clary, a lot of the problems that end up in dementia or other cognitive problems in later life are stress-related from earlier in one's life. So let's talk about stress. I mean, some people, you would look at them and you'd think they've got to be stressed out. They're going 24/7. This woman's going to work. She has four kids at home. She's cooking dinner. She's picking up the dry cleaning. She's got responsibilities at work. She's taking the little league, blah, blah, blah. It must be incredibly stressful. And yet, she's taking it all in stride. Is she stressed or is she hiding it?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think that
– And if you don't feel stressed, are you stressed?
Well, and I think the perception of what someone shows is far different than what someone may actually display. There's so much pressure on society today to function at a higher level. Mm-hmm. We're all demanded and work at higher levels than even we were a decade ago because of economic structures within the globe. I don't think there's a great deal of difference of stress between working that kind of job and probably more stress for the woman who stays at home, who may be in a single family, who has children she's trying to support. There's so much pressure on children today for performance in school, whether it's academic and athletic, and the mother, the woman in the home, takes that pressure significantly if she's
at home. But if you thrive because you love being a mother, you love raising your kids, you like your job at work, you don't mind juggling 14 footballs at once, then is that stress to you? Or is it fun? Is it just part of life? And this, I'll get through this because this is what's expected, and by God, I can do it well. I mean, is that stress?
It's hormonal and genetic. I don't think we understand a way to appreciate that because I guess the best example would be why when there's an airplane crash and people survive, why do not all of them develop post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms? Why is it that some people who are involved in and I know this sounds not good, but are in lesser trauma develop more traumatic symptoms? Suppose that you're in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, but you're in Saigon, and the only thing that you really hear is the bombs in the background, and yet you develop post-traumatic stress symptoms, whereas there are people on the front lines who are fighting who don't.
So it's individual.
Correct.
Are there symptoms that you can look for in yourself or your spouse or others around you that would let you know that this person is under stress and needs to be maybe guided out of it some way?
From a psychological standpoint, I think everybody else would probably have a better knowledge of that. But I'd say from a psychiatric medical standpoint, irritability especially, shortness of temper, lack of patience, poor sleep.
Fatigue.
I think all of those things add up together to suggest that that there are problems in which you're coping with things.
And will they have – that's the normal stress of life. That's not a traumatic event. But will the stresses of the normal stresses of life – will they compound later in life to lead to cognitive impairment?
Oh, I think clearly. I don't think there's enough scientific evidence to support the mechanism by which it takes place, but I think that if you look at cortisol levels and all these other things hormonally that alter inflammation in the body that allow people because of stress, I mean, clearly coronary artery disease, diabetes, fibromyalgia, migraine headaches, especially in women. All those disorders tend to become more forefront.
If women handle stress better than men, as you said a second ago, why do these things seem to exhibit and present more often in women than in men? Or do they? Or do we just see them because women go to the doctor more often than men?
I think that is very true. I think a lot of the disorders are recognized in women because they present, but culturally, they still have a tremendous difficulty expressing those feelings. What you'll see is people who are high utilizers of the healthcare system tend to have issues like that going on, and they'll get abdominal pain or headaches or some other things that are kind of diffuse and difficult to necessarily diagnose because they find it very difficult to say, you know, I've got three kids and I got one going to college and I got this and I got that, and it's stressful, and there's an embarrassment, a shame to feel as though one is unable to do the role that you feel that you are supposed to do. And I put that in quotes because I don't know what that really is supposed to be. But I think that the shame of failure, perceived failure, adds up to this.
Dr. Greg Clary, Medical Director of In-N-Out Patient Psychiatry at Novant Health. Also with us, Lyndall Hare with The Respite. She's a gerontologist, and we will, I promise, be talking to Sandy Lloyd Person when we come back as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Group Benefit Solutions, providing clarity to Carolina companies uncertain about health care reform. Details available at gbs-benefits.com. And Northeastern University Charlotte, a not-for-profit university with 3,000 corporate partners offering degrees in energy systems, engineering and project management, education, and more. Boston, Seattle, Charlotte, and beyond. Networked for life. Northeastern.edu. Well, the government shutdown and Washington's trip to the brink on the debt ceiling crisis from earlier this month really isn't over. Lawmakers are going to be revisiting all of this in the very near future. But more importantly, the impact of government inaction will have some lasting consequences. And there is some dispute among experts about what those consequences may or may not be. We have our own folks coming in Monday to talk about this and give us their point of view at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm show, the Friday News Roundup. Contractors testify on the Hill about problems with the rollout of the Affordable Care Act website. Same-sex marriage becomes legal in New Jersey. And President Obama renews calls for Congress to pass immigration reform.
That's the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show. Join us from 10 to noon here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about women and midlife crisis, although it bleeds over into men, and the how stress can compound over time and or a traumatic event can result in problems in later life, cognitive problems in later life. The Swedish study that we referenced that started in 1968 used as one of the markers divorce as a traumatic event in midlife that perhaps ended up in Alzheimer's or dementia in later life. But that was 1968. They followed these women over 37 years. A lot of people get divorced today. Far more people get divorced today than got divorced in the 50s and 60s. And there used to be a terrible stigma attached to divorce, which there doesn't seem to be anymore. So if this study began today, and 37 years from now, we were looking back at how these people did in life, would divorce have the same impact on their lives, the same negative, traumatic impact on their lives that it did then?
Can I just say that one of the things that I think about immediately when you ask that question is that even though women make up 53% of the workforce at this point, which in itself creates stresses and midlife issues. The other thing is that, by and large, there is a financial impact. And if women are then ending up caring, being the primary caregiver, maybe even, you know, sharing care, et cetera, with the father of the children, but if they're landed with the burden of being a single caregiver and then also dealing with perhaps a mother who is needing care and working full-time and having to bring in the bacon, then that could be, you know, all of those factors could compound the level of stress of that event.
But in 1968, this is just at the very beginnings of the feminist movement and women going to work, women who were divorced suddenly found themselves at home with no job and no job prospects. And still some of the same things that you're talking about, caring for the kids, caring for their parents, whatever. Now they have income. Does that lessen the trauma? I mean, yes, it picks up the responsibilities of life have increased because you got to go to work too, but has that lessened the trauma? Because money, lack of money, is a real problem for people.
Sure. And I think, Mike, the workforce is a stressful place to be these days for women, I think.
So you think it's, in other words, you think it's the same, that the impact of divorce might be the same as it was in 1968?
I really can't say.
Can't say, okay.
Yeah.
Whether the Swedish study is completely accurate or not, the annual Stress in America survey reports that more than half of Americans say they get little or no help in managing stress from healthcare providers. If you agree, why would that be so? Because, you know, if you have a constant headache or a stomach ache, we'd see our doctor. Why don't we go to our doctor or a psychologist or a psychiatrist to get help with stress, chronic stress?
I think the stigma of feeling stress, feeling inadequate, is shameful to a great deal of people. And so that's why you get people who are more higher utilizers of the healthcare system and being able to discuss it. As well, and I'll have to take responsibility here as being a physician, the healthcare system right now, the way that it is inadequate to address these situations.
How so?
Well, I think the volume production model of healthcare is luckily going away, but still present. And
by that you mean you have limited time to talk to patients
because
you've got to move them through to make enough money to exist.
And and there was a lecture I heard one time from a guy at the University of Virginia Medical School talked about the infamous reaching for the door and someone says, oh, by the way, I'm depressed. And then and then saying to oneself, oh, my gosh, I've got to get to the next patient who's going to be waiting and I'm running late and da-da-da-da-da-da. And then the importance of pharmacological management became even more pressured that here is some sertraline, here's some fluoxetine, move on. And I don't think that addresses the problem. And then being able to get referred to a psychiatrist. I mean, even in our outpatient clinic can be weeks. And it's just the services are just inadequate.
Let's go back to the stigma. Is the stigma real or is it imaginary? In other words, do we think I'm not going to go see a psychologist or I'm not going to go see a psychiatrist because people think I'm crazy. So I'm not going to do that. But do people really think you're crazy or is it in your mind? The stigma, I mean.
I think the stigma is real because I've seen patients who come in and they'll feel embarrassed or shamed about feeling weak or inadequate or their own perception of that, despite the fact that they're probably doing more than half the population on the planet. I try and get them to relate to hypertension and diabetes. Would you feel bad if you know, are you feeling inadequate because you're taking antihypertensive medication? No. It's an illness that needs to be treated, and psychiatric illness is the same way. Is therapy or medication or is this, that, or the other more effective or less effective than the others? A lot of it works in combination together, but a lot of it depends upon the person themselves. What are they comfortable with?
At the Respite, you've already mentioned that you deal a lot with people who are caregivers and the stresses that they are going through as caregivers. What are some of the other problems that you deal with, help people with at the Respite?
Well, the Respite as a whole has a model that's been developed by Mandy Epley, who was one of the founders of the Respite, and Chris Saade, and it's a seven-step model of grief and hope. And the premise of the model is that any loss can eventually be turned into some sort of way of using that loss as a transformation experience. And so the Respite is actually an example of that, where the other co-founder is Elizabeth Berrien, and she lost her husband in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and became a widow at a very young age and started thinking about how, when she got so much support, Mike, how much what she could do to bring her grief into something positive for other women who had lost their husbands or spouses, husbands or partners. And so that's how the Respite was born, out of the ashes of sort of the Phoenix Rising model, as it were. And so we do a lot. We do more of an integrative health approach where we have art therapy, we have massage therapy. I work mostly with aging transitions on the team. Mandy is a licensed therapist, so she's been dealing with grief issues as a therapist for 20 plus years. So we have a panoply of services that we offer. I also offer workshops, one of them being When Memories Fade, which is for people who are caring for someone with dementia. And then I also have another day-long workshop called Pausing. And what I find, in answer to the question that you asked Greg earlier, the isolation that happens when we are going through perimenopause, menopause, women just so many times have come to these workshops and said, I didn't know anybody else was experiencing this. And that even though we have support groups, we have lots of things going on in the community, it's really hard for people to access that. And our healthcare system doesn't reimburse for these things. And I think that's really hard. Even those of us who have good health insurance, we don't, for instance, there's mindfulness-based stress reduction that's being offered by Lindsay Bridges here in Charlotte. It's a wonderful 8-week series. There's solid research over 25 years that's proven that meditation can help with stress, and nobody would reimburse for that, whereas that could address a lot of health issues down the road. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's so many factors that come into play that create an isolation feel for people who are going through this.
You've used the word transition a couple mm-hmm. of times in what you just said, and midlife crisis. Really, if it's just the midlife crisis, if it's not somebody dying or some horrible tragedy in your life that just happens to happen at midlife, the midlife crisis is dealing with the transition from youth to your later life.
Absolutely.
Is that a good way to look at all of these? Because this happens throughout life. It doesn't just happen in midlife. It happens from your teens to your 20s, from your 20s to your 30s, 30s to your 40s, midlife to later life, elder life to death. It happens repeatedly. Is it a is it less stressful if you begin to think about these things as just transitory periods?
I think what would be less stressful, and this is the philosophy I come to this with, is that if we mark it, for instance, you know, in the Jewish tradition, there's a bar mitzvah. Mm-hmm. When we move from childhood to adolescence, there are many transitions that are marked by ritual in different cultures, and so I'm all about marking this transition and having a rite of passage, and that's what this pausing workshop does, is we actually go through a rite of passage, because in rites of passage, we're leaving something behind, and then we're at this threshold that we're standing on that is the transitional piece of this, and then we move to integrating what we've left behind into something new. And our society doesn't do well with rites of passage, period. I mean, we don't want to talk about death. We don't want to talk about aging. And so I always joke with my colleagues at the respite that we're trying to get people to talk about two of the hardest things to talk about, which is death, aging, and loss and grief. But I think it's important for us to mark these transitions. And so that's the premise that I come from in terms of transitioning. And those are hard. Think about adolescence. Think about, you know, all the things that we do as, you know, normal life development, yeah, life course development. It's tough.
And that brings us to Sandy. Sandy Lloyd Person has a master's in social work. She's a practicing licensed clinical social worker. You've seen a lot of stress, I'm sure, in your practice with the people that you work with, but you're here not to talk about that. You're here because you say you've experienced and are experiencing the stress of a life transition. Your twins have left the nest. They're off in college, and you and your husband are dealing with becoming empty nesters. Now, on the surface, that sounds like liberating to me, but obviously not.
Well, it's a mix, you know. I'm thinking with Lyndall talking, you know, the transitions related to stress and distress. I mean, it was stressful having kids at home, working, you know, running carpools, managing schedules, buying socks, whatever. And that's stressful. The distress for me has been the transition. You know, I have twins, so they left abruptly. You know, they were all here and then they were all gone, just like they came into the world. And that transition, I mean, the transition for me of my kids leaving home has been equally significant to the day they were born. You know, and I find, I found this when they were born, I find this as they leave, although there's informal conversations I have with friends and, of course, my husband and whatnot, there aren't formal rites of passage, no formal transitions. You know, I mean, part of my heart craves creating some kind of ritual, which I could do on my own, but it would be nice if there were places where that was set up, mm-hmm, that made this transition.
Is it simply that these two people who have been part of your life for 18 years
And are still part of my life.
Yeah, but they were there in your presence.
Every day she calls me.
Yeah, 24/7. Well, that's true. Today it's a little different because kids never leave. They got the cell phone.
Stop calling me.
But is it because there's an emptiness because they're not there 24/7, 365? They're away at college? Or is it because they are at the beginnings of their adult lives, and that means you're coming to the end of the snake?
Well, it's both, of course. You know, I mean, it is empty, and it's a strange feeling in our home, you know, just not having the busyness and the comings and goings all the time, of course. And at the same time, you know, I'm facing aging parents. I'm facing perimenopause. I'm facing, you know, all sorts of second half of life, you know, opportunities, challenges. You know, some of it's really exciting and some of it's sad. There's a grief process. And with grief, you know, as Lyndall mentioned, the phoenix, you know, there's new life ready to be born, and it's not well marked. Mm-hmm. You know, it is in our house because we feel it, but it's not in the culture, and it leaves, for me at least, me feeling a little out of sorts or lost.
Are you handling this differently, better, worse than your husband?
Well, in some ways we had, you know, I don't know. That's a good question. I think that the busyness of it affects me very differently because I probably did more of the busyness. I managed the household more and I worked part-time while he was working full-time. So You know, I think the grief is there. I don't hear him talking about needing ritual transition as much as I feel like I'm talking about we need to mark this somehow, or we need to take a big trip. What would that ritual look like?
If you've talked about this, and you've talked about it too, Linda. What would these rites of passage look like if they were going to be helpful?
Well, that's a good question. I've never seen them. you know, I think, you know, in my mother's generation, you know, when this time happened, it seemed like grandkids were coming along from the oldest child. So by the time the youngest child left the home, there were grandkids. So mothers who were home or home and working, or a little of both, as I was, became grandparents when they became empty nesters. So
there was no break in the action.
They incorporated a new role, and that was a nice – it made the transition a little more fluid possibly.
But doesn't becoming a grandparent – isn't that also stressful, because it does remind you, oh, my God, I'm old enough to be a grandparent, so I'm looking at death.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to be blunt, but that's –
It does.
Yeah. Yeah. But and mortality, because that's the new life and, you know, the legacy that we leave. And so for those of us who are grandparents, I think there's something life-giving about that too, obviously, because it's passing on to new generations. But it is also a loss and a transition for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
On the other hand, your twins, is it a boy and girl or two?
Boy and a girl.
Boy and
yes.
a girl. Your twins are off at college, and they're embarking on this new life. I don't know how privy you are to their inner thoughts at that age, but are they excited by this, or are they too going through something that is difficult internally for them?
Well, yes. I mean, they are excited, and I'm happy. They're both happy. They love where they are. And it's scary for them too. I mean, they're not even a quarter life transition, but maybe, right. You know, I mean, of course it's they're holding both sides of that. You know, yeah. They're excited and they're petrified.
She just said quarter life, because we used to just have the midlife crisis, and now people are having quarter life crises. This sounds silly on the surface, but is it? It's not, is it?
No, not really. I think the word transition is probably the better part of valor. And I think part of it, you know, we've talked about, well, why does it seem now the transition from motherhood and then the children grow up and go away? I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, previously in history, the extended family was there and there was more support for everyone from that extended family, whereas today in society, for better or worse, we are very much satellites around an environment. And so the support mechanisms that were there that may have been from mother, brother, sister, mom, dad, aren't there to provide that from an extended family. And so that you're lost on your own, again, like a satellite, searching for something to help you through those transitions.
And yet, as Linda will testify, when there are older parents, it does seem to continue. The stress of having to deal with them. We have to take a break. We'll talk about all this when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members in Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Matthew Bourne's Sleeping Beauty, a gothic romance about good versus evil. If it's ballet, meets Broadway November 5th through the 10th in Belk Theater. Tickets at BlumenthalPerformingArts.org. And Audi of Charlotte, presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction, East Independence Boulevard, inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, truth in engineering. Information at Audi of Charlotte. .com. Contractors testify on the Hill about problems with the rollout of the Affordable Care Act website. Same-sex marriage becomes legal in New Jersey. President Obama renews calls for Congress to pass immigration reform. And that just scratches the surface of what a panel of journalists will talk about with Diane Rehm in the weekly news roundup coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is a great place to start, and we're coming right back.
As mid-November draws light from the day, what better way to brighten things up than with a live performance of Says You? On Saturday, November 16th and Sunday, November 17th, we're coming to the Pease Auditorium in Charlotte for two shows. Tickets, information, and details are available on our website at sayu.net. That's S-A-Y-S-Y-O-U. Remember, that's November 16th and 17th, a mid-semester break with Says You.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about midlife crises and the role they may play or may not play in later life cognitive problems, and not just midlife crises, but crises in life, dramatic events. Dr. Greg Clary is with us. He's the medical director of In-N-Out Patient Psychiatry at Novant Health. Lyndall Hare is a gerontologist and a midlife transitions aging specialist with The Respite. And Sandy Lloyd Pearson is a licensed clinical social worker, but also an empty nester, and that's what she's here to talk about, her own dealing with this midlife transition as her twins leave the nest and go off to college. That's a difficult period, and we were talking about how these periods end up in a different kind of life, and how in the older days, as kids got old enough to go to college, grandchildren were coming into the picture. Today, we still have mothers taking care of children and taking care of their parents. So what's the difference? Because we used to look back at families who lived in the same house, generations were there. What's the difference today?
Well, I think what Greg said is really important, that we live very isolated lives in this country specifically. I mean, we're very individual focused, that's very hard. I just was at a women's group last night, and a couple of people said in their neighborhoods that they've lived in for 30 years, they don't feel a sense of community.
Right.
And so, you know, we close the door, we've got air conditioning, the front porch is gone, you know, in terms of being able to sit there and see our neighbors.
So we're the only people going through this. We're alone in this. Nobody else is experiencing this. When in fact
don't
know it.
And that's what it feels like, Mike, when somebody comes into my office and says, you know, this is my unique experience here, but it's not a unique experience, but for them it feels that way.
But you're obviously not alone. I mean, your friends are probably around your age. Your friends are probably having kids going off to college. I mean, do you talk about this with them and the things that you're experiencing?
Yeah, sure. You know, like I mentioned earlier, I mean, there's informally we talk about this kind of thing. And I think often we're all sort of at a loss. I mean, what does my friend say to me when I say I don't know what I'm going to do when my kids leave, or when she says that? And I don't have a good response to that. And I think a lot of us feel that way. There's no net to catch us.
But these are transitory feelings. I mean, eventually she will work through this. Other people will work through this. This is just part of life. Is this the kind of stress, because this certainly puts stress on your life, and it does lead to depression in some cases, is this the kind of stress and depression that leads to cognitive impairment later in life, or is this something that we just learn to deal with, it rolls off our back, eventually we move on with life?
I think we may think that we're moving on with life, but I think there's an accumulation of what happens to your neurochemistry over time. There were some studies that Nemiroff did and Emory before he went to Miami, and showed that they were doing animal models of giving an animal trauma in a younger life and then seeing and following forward what happens to the neurochemistry, the neuroanatomy of the brain from that trauma, and whether or not in a total life experience – that trauma adds up over time. And I think you have to take in consideration if you're in
So it's cumulative.
Yeah. I mean, if you're raised in a home that is – there's something distorted there from a psychiatric, psychological standpoint. Well, your entire life you think it's normal until you're exposed to other environments that show that it was abnormal. So you have this stress that accumulates over time. That dictates what your neurochemistry is going to do for the rest of your life.
Well, you asked a question at the very beginning of the show that I'm not sure we've answered, because you said we need to define what is stress. And how do you define that? Is it simply looking at activities that affect you, or is it what's happening chemically in your body and in your brain?
Again, both, I think.
So what is happening chemically?
Well, usually, I guess the classified type of things that go around is that you secrete a hormone, cortisol, basically, that is it's the fight-or-flight type existence. The problem is if you do that long-term, then you have a degree of inflammation in your body that's not adjusted to well. And they've done studies and shown that increased stress, increased cortisol levels leads to increased coronary artery disease and other vascular diseases.
Can we offset that through diet or exercise or therapy?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Whichever one is more effective. I mean, right, we're all trying our best to find ways to ease our stress and have a better quality of life. Whether it's therapy, medication, exercise, I think you have to find what's individually best for you.
How are you coping? How do you get through this every day? I'm sure it's not on your mind 24/7, but I'm sure there are periods when you think, I miss the kids, or what am I going to do now?
Sure. I exercise regularly. I get together with friends. I work.
Do you think you're handling it well? Do you feel stressed by this? Do you feel that this is something you need to be concerned about long term?
You know, I think I'm handling it very well, and I think that it's hard and it's stressful. You know, and it's painful at times, and it's distress. I mean, it's grief, and I think that I am handling it well, and that doesn't mean that I don't feel it.
Right.
Handling it well would not look like the mother who seems to have everything together and nobody thinks that she is stressed because she doesn't show it.
You deal with a lot of pain in at the respite, with people going through a great deal of very real pain. That's part of life. Should they not feel that pain and work through that pain and get out to be on the other side of that pain and leave that pain behind rather than denying the pain and not working through the pain?
Well, Mike, I think the problem that we see a lot, not only at the respite but in society in general, is the denying of grief, the denying of loss, the denying of...
Why do we do that? Why do we deny
Because we live in a culture where we've just got to get through it, and as Mandy at the respite always says, you know, get over it and in 3.5 days you'll be fine and get back to work and then just, you know, shove it under the carpet. And I think that's one of the issues that we face as a society. And so trying to swim upstream with this and go against the grain in terms of how we deal with grief and loss and transitions is a tough one. And we're seeing more and more that people are willing to come in and speak about these things in a way that is helpful to them and to seek the help.
There are hormonal changes at midlife.
Yes.
And I think you referenced these, Doctor.
Yes.
Particularly for women who are going through menopause. And these hormonal changes can impair judgment or impair cognitive ability then and probably later on. What about men? Are we going through the same thing in a different way or to the same degree? We just don't have a name for it?
I think absolutely. It's probably true that we're going through the things. And there are hormonal changes taking place in men and women. I think women, to their credit, are more able to express their emotional feelings in a way that can expose some of these things. And men, on the other hand, you know, get back in the game, get out there and play, you know, put some tape on it, get out there. And that's the mentality. The problem is getting back out there leads to more injury, mm-hmm. leads to more stress, leads to more problems later on in life. I mean, clearly, in coronary artery disease, the stressful events and emotional stress leads to increased risk of coronary artery disease in men and women. And women's rates are less so than men, and men's are a little bit higher. But the problem is 30 years ago, 50 years ago, those types of things didn't exist. And the way that society has evolved and the stress has escalated upwards so that all these diseases in women are approaching the levels that are in men.
Is that because women are in the workplace now and have even more responsibility than probably the men do because they're also running the house?
I think it's true just because of the amount of stress that's on a female, mm-hmm. that they're supposed to be in the home, out of the home, this, running that, running
they're,
this.
They're supposed to
That's
have
right.
it all. They're supposed to be superwoman.
The realistic expectations are – they're incredible for a female or a male, but I think they're higher in females because of the fact they have to be the caregivers and stability of the home.
I want to preface this question by pointing out that it came from a woman. We have producers who are women here, believe it or not, and I'm going to ask the question, but it came from a woman. So I don't want to be a bad guy here. Does the way women are impacted by stress and trauma have anything to do with monthly cycles? I mean, if you're on the pill for a long time, do your hormones are being synthetically altered? And once you get off the pill to get pregnant, or because you're going into middle age and you stop taking it, is there a learning curve in learning how to deal with emotions that you may not have felt for a long time because your hormones were being synthetically altered?
You know, I think that's just an excellent question, and I've really thought a lot about this over the years, and I've been looking and looking and looking for research on the correlation between the impact and the severity of menopausal symptoms. And those of us who are of the pill generation, you know, we're the first or the second generation that's been on the pill for long periods of time, and it alters, as this person is saying, it alters our hormonal levels and artificially. And so I just cannot imagine that after being on the pill for a number of years, I just believe that it has to have an impact on how we go through menopause and how menopausal symptoms are exacerbated. I have no basis of fact in that.
And how you transition into later life.
Yeah. And Mike, I think one of the things that's so lonely about going through menopause, even though we joke about, you know, the hot flashes and all of that to make, you know, in some ways to make fun of it and to, you know, just to cope.
Mm-hmm.
The way that I've described it for myself was that I was working full time and in a PhD program. And I went to a friend of mine who was a little older than me and said, would you be my menopause mentor and tell me what this is all about? Because I'm feeling crazy. And I felt as though I was looking through binoculars and a microscope at the same time.
Well, that's the other thing. Women seem to do this so much better than men. Women have conversations. They talk about things that are meaningful, that are impactful in their lives. Men say they grunt a lot and they talk about the Panthers. That's their way of communicating. I mean, you're having conversations. You've talked about it with girlfriends and mm-hmm. other women who are going through similar things in their lives. Is your husband?
Am I talking with my husband?
Is he talking with guys about these things? Probably not.
Well, actually, he probably is.
Okay.
But he's probably the exception more than the rule. You know, I think you're right. I think that men generally don't talk about this, and women are far more verbal and communicative, and even in joking, even if we're joking about hot flashes, it's still a way to be communicative.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think in general men do. I think there are some men that do, and I think it's an intentional choice.
What do you find in your practice?
I would say in a general psychiatric practice, the practices are dominated by female patients. I mean, all the studies show that. And I think, again,
part of that because they're having more difficulty coping, or is it because they're more willing to get help?
I think they're more willing to get help. Again, the fantasy that we all live under is that there's one hormone that does this, and there's one hormone that does this, and there's this. They're all interacting.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, whether it's the pituitary or the adrenal gland, they're all interacting. If you want to alter anything, everything's going to be messed up.
So how do you and your colleagues target stress? How do you help patients deal with this? Is it through therapy? Is it through drugs? Is it simply talking through the fact that you're going from one stage of life to another, this too shall pass? How do you do it?
A lot of it has to do with patient preference and what they want to adapt to. I mean, clearly studies have shown that the combination of therapy with medication is probably better over time.
And if stress is a symptom of something deeper, it's the symptom of something that's wrong in your life that needs to be changed, a balance that needs to be achieved. How does medication help? I mean, why don't you go after the problem and address it? And balance out life to remove the stress as opposed to prescribing a drug.
Insurance doesn't reimburse for that.
Well, that's a damn fine question. I mean, that's a horrible answer. I mean, it's a horrible answer. That's true. It's true. But why?
Well, as I tell my patients, the ones that are in medical management and pharmacologically is the medicines open the door and let the light come in. That's about 70% of what's going to happen. Whether or not you go to the other side is really up to you, whether it's therapy or willingness or whatever to face the problem. If somebody's been on five different antidepressants and they keep coming in and, you know, my job is driving me crazy. My job is driving me crazy. And you sit there and go, change your job. Nobody wants to do that because that's a very difficult thing.
Aren't you just masking the problem and causing further problems down the road? I'm not pointing fingers at the doctor.
No, I agree.
Also you, the patient.
I agree. I totally agree with that because the fact of facing what the issue is and believing that the pill is the answer may or may not be a good answer. You just never know, and I think people's desperateness in this 60-second society.
So since these problems, these stressors in our lives, are cumulative and can cause problems later in life with dementia and other cognitive things, are there ways to remove the cumulative effects over time if we work at it so that we don't go into these problems later in life?
I think if you can decrease the amount of stress in your life that is unnecessary, and that's in quotes because the fact that what is unnecessary stress. You can't remove that you got a 16-year-old who's driving to get his girlfriend at 11 o'clock at night and you sit there and you wait for him. You can't decrease the stress of worrying about your twins in college and being in a different town and you can't control what they're doing. You can't control the IRS or your boss. And being able to walk away from issues like that and understanding that, whether it's religious comfort or whatever.
But the key here, I suppose, no matter what it is, if you really feel oppressed by this, is to get help. And there are a number of ways to do that. Depending on what your situation is. Dr. Greg Clary, Medical Director of In-N-Out Patient Psychiatry at Novant Health, Lyndall Hare, Gerontologist and Midlife Transitions Aging Specialist with The Respite, and Sandy Lloyd Person. Thank you all for the hour. Appreciate it.
Thank you.